Now, the fight against terrorism took center stage following the attacks in New York and Washington on September 11, 2001. In the nearly 20 years since that attack, the United States government and governments around the world have poured billions of dollars into the war against terror. There have been significant military victories against extremist groups like Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. But our next guest says we've missed a big piece of the puzzle, and that leaves an open door to extremist violence in the future. She says there are better ways to combat terrorism outside of just military action, and that engaging in a war of ideas can likely prevent people from becoming radicalized in the first place. Farah Pandith is a foreign policy strategist and former diplomat who worked in the George W. Bush and Barack Obama administrations. She's currently an adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and she's the author of the book How We Win, How Cutting-Edge Entrepreneurs, Political Visionaries, Enlightened Business Leaders, and Social Media Mavens Can Defeat the Extremist Threat. Farah, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Will you make the point in the book, military victories, military action is sometimes necessary, but that's not enough. Have you seen too much focus on military efforts to stop terrorism?
We absolutely have. I think it's vital to remember that we need a physical force and we need to be able to diminish the armies of terrorists. However, we also need to be focusing on stopping the recruitment of people to enter their armies. And that requires us to be very vigilant about how we think about the ideology that recruits young people into their armies. We have done very little to be able to scale up the things that we know can make a difference in stopping that recruitment.
Let's talk about one of the main characters in your book, and that's a massive generation of millennial Muslims and younger than millennials now, I imagine. Can you talk about the identity crisis you describe in your book?
Absolutely. I think it's important to state, in the context of where we are today on the planet, there's been a rise of hate, as everybody knows. The us versus them ideologies are not just positioned to attract young people to groups like the so-called Islamic State or ISIS. We've seen a surge, obviously, in white nationalists as well. But in this book, I talk about what I have observed in nearly 100 countries around the world when I traveled on behalf of the United States government. And the young people that I focus on were young Muslims under the age of 30. And as you rightly say, that number is gigantic. It's a billion people strong globally. That's the demographic from which the bad guys recruit. And we have very few antibodies in the system globally to prevent those young people to be attracted when recruiters come after them to join their ranks.
Let's talk about the crisis of identity they face a little more. You see people from Muslims in Europe to Muslims in Muslim-majority countries confronting things from the West that they might like, popular culture, clothing, and so on the one side, and then messages from often more conservative members of the Muslim faith on the other, and trying to figure out where they fit into all of that.
Well, one of the things that was dramatic for me was no matter where I went in the world, whether I was in a Muslim majority country or a Muslim community that in which Muslims lived as minorities, the singular data point that connected these young people was that they were asking questions about who they are and how to belong, which was very, very specific to a post 9/11 environment. And that crisis of identity was the vulnerability from which we need to be able to even look at this issue, because the bad guys know that these young people are dealing with a crisis of identity, and they are offering answers in a peer-friendly way that makes these young people find what they are selling appealing. And so that crisis of identity is not something that we should ignore, but rather something that we should plan for and organize ourselves around. That's actually the data point that connects all of the millennial Muslims around the world, and indeed what you just said, the millennial underneath them, the Generation Z.
Farah Pandith is with us talking about her new book, How We Win. It's about how the United States and others can try to stop the threat of extremism and the online recruiting of young people to become extremists. Farah, let's talk about who's providing these answers. So a young Muslim might go online and say, hey, how do I be a Muslim in this world today? Who is stepping up to answer that question for them?
You know, in the past, you know, it would happen in a family. You know, they would go to their parents or they would go to community elders to actually ask questions about how to navigate their identity, how to navigate their religion. But what has happened in the context of post 9/11 is that these digital natives are, of course, going to the platforms that they trust, that are peer-friendly platforms that hear answers from people that they find credible and authentic. In a chapter in the book that I call Shake Google, they go online and get answers that seem to make sense for them. They're not necessarily the right answers, but they're answers that are delivered in a way that seem like they are the right answers, and they allow those young people to be connected on the other side of their screens with people who are actually working on recruiting them to move them in a direction that allow them to have one-on-one conversations and eventually get them to a place where they buy into the ideology of extremism.
What kind of efforts have you seen and participated in under the State Department auspices and national security auspices to try to provide a different message?
What we understood is that we cannot defeat extremists like Al-Qaeda or the so-called Islamic State or Boko Haram or other groups like it if we are only looking at the physical dimension of the war. We have to do more to be able to disrupt the way in which the bad guys are recruiting. And that ideological war is really critical. Even though the United States has spent very little money on the ideological component of the war, we have actually market tested and piloted some programs that have promise that could be scaled at this very moment to be able to stop young kids from being recruited.
Tell us how one of those projects might work.
Well, let's take the most obvious, right? The most obvious kind of credible voice for a young person who finds the ideology of the so-called Islamic State appealing would be someone who is a former extremist, somebody who used to be part of the Islamic State and is now coming back saying, I'm not part of that organization anymore. I don't find it appealing. So too with other kinds of extremist groups. So these former extremists have credibility. They have the capacity to be able to tell very different kinds of stories than the stories these young people hear. And they're effective in their ability to be true and credible to these young people because they're often peers that they can speak to. Why we learned all of this, we absorbed the content of these young people and we were able to deploy it in ways that made sense for these young folks. So the network of former extremists that was built way back in the Bush administration that has scaled to several hundred today are a perfect place where we could look to build the kinds of programs that we know can work even today. Yet we aren't seeing the kind of interaction from the United States government in the Trump era to scale up what the U.S. government has already tested and piloted.
Under the previous two administrations, the second Bush administration and the Obama administration, and even then, while you heard some sympathy for your message of the need to counter messages of violent extremism online, it seems to have gone in fits and starts at the best.
It has not been taken seriously. The language that comes out of Washington is serious. People are talking about how important it is to fight the ideology, but the money doesn't match the rhetoric. Congress has not put the money into the U.S. State Department budget to be able to deploy the kinds of personnel and programs around the world. We haven't put the money into the Department of Homeland Security to scale up what we know works. And it leaves us lacking. It leaves us where we are today, without a strategy, without a program, without a comprehensive attack on the ideological war. And there's no way we can stop recruitment if all we're doing is doing things in fits and starts.
Among a lot of the young people you talk to around the world, young Muslims, there's a lot of skepticism about the United States. Even if they like aspects of American popular culture, there's skepticism about the American government. Does that stand in the way of an American government-led effort to combat extremist messages?
Let me redefine that. The United States-led effort is not something in which the U.S. flag is placed next to every program we do out there. It is the way in which you build partnerships at the grassroots level with local community members that know what we need to do. The greatest strength of the U.S. government is to be the convener and the facilitator and the intellectual partner with the ideas that we hear on the ground. The foot soldiers are not the U.S. government. The foot soldiers here are localized, nuanced programs by community members that know what to do within their own communities, but they need help. These are NGOs. These are communities that require the kinds of coalitions that U.S. help can help build. It requires the money that can come from both the private sector, from philanthropy, and yes, some U.S. government and other government money, but also it requires the sophistication of an effort that is not a whack-a-mole kind of strategy, but rather a comprehensive assessment. 20 years after 9/11, we know what works. We know we have tested things and piloted things all across the world, yet we have no government in the world or entity that has scaled up what needs to happen in a real way. And so that's why you have the situation that we have at this very moment.
Chakra Farah Pandith, author of the new book, How We Win, How Cutting-Edge Entrepreneurs, Political Visionaries, Enlightened Business Leaders, and Social Media Mavens Can Defeat the Extremist Threat. She's with us to talk about how various groups, including governments and social media experts, can work together to defeat extremism. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the priorities our guest says we need from the American government and others to combat extremist messages online? How would you like to see our approach to combating extremism change? At the local level, have you participated in any kind of interfaith outreach efforts, bringing together people from different faith traditions, Christians, Muslims, beyond? Are you a Muslim millennial yourself? Do you see the identity crisis our guest was talking about earlier? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Farah Pandith, adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. She's with us to talk about the ways we can counter extremist messages. She outlines these in her new book, How We Win, How Cutting-Edge Entrepreneurs, Political Visionaries, Enlightened Business Leaders, and Social Media Mavens Can Defeat the Extremist Threat. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions for our guest, maybe even your personal experiences. Have you traveled the world or the country talking to people from Muslim communities? Are you Muslim yourself? What do you think about American efforts to counter extremist messages around the world or here at home? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll bring on a caller now. Nate is with us in Mazamani. Nate, hi.
Thank you for taking my call. This may seem a little esoteric, but I want to try and make a point. I think the presenter, when talking about a grassroots approach to solving this problem, that's kind of what I've been doing for a decade, working on domestic politics. But I think both of us run into the same problem, which is that Americans tend to want to solve problems easily and quickly. And I think it's part of I'm a history background, and I think we have this frontier mentality that we can just go out there and solve things quickly and easily. And the kind of problem we're confronting with terrorists and a lot of other political issues are not amenable to quick and easy answers.
Nate, thanks a lot for the call. Farah, he's worried that we want quick fixes to long-term problems.
Nate, I think you ask a very, rather point out a very important thing. The grassroots is actually the solution here, as you and I both know. I think Americans actually, when you look at the fact that we've had 20 years since 9/11 to look at this issue, we've missed so many opportunities because of scale and inaction in the capacity of doing more at the grassroots level. We've been waiting for the perfect thing that we need to do, and I think perfection has stopped us from being able to try things out. We have to be a little bit willing to be risk takers here and to try a lot of things. One of the things I hear a lot is, if you try this program, can you convince me that that young person will never become a terrorist or an extremist? And there's no guarantee on the human development of someone. You can try your best to build antibodies in the system, but there's no perfect cure. So one piece of it is what Nate's saying, which is you want a quick answer, but there's also a component of you want the perfect answer. The solution here in all of the things that I've seen since 9/11 is that we have tested and experimented with a wide range and a wide set of programs, a lot of different types of things in an offline and in an online space that have promise. The issue today is that we haven't scaled it. We haven't been able to see what needs to be done. So to Nate's point, what would be quick and easy would be simply to scale everything that we've tested over the last 20 years to see what can happen. And I think a lot more can happen than we could expect if we actually did that. But instead, we've just sort of stopped in our tracks and are not doing what we know we should do.
Nate, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Andre in Winona, Minnesota. Andre, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Andre?
Well, I just wanted to make a comment about it. Really, I find it really bizarre that this country is a so-called great United States of America. What was his name? Ronald Reagan said the city on the shining hill. You know, these guys want to go over and blow up other countries and kill up people, innocent people, and call them extremists and stuff. And I think what they should do, seriously, is clean up this filth that they have in their own country, such as neo-Nazis, Ku Klux Klan. These guys have been around since 1860-something. They were started in Pulaski, Tennessee. They're still, you know, it's just unbelievable how they can let these guys off the hook.
Andre, thanks for the call. Farah, clean up extremism here at home first, Andre says.
Well, look, I think we have all been lazy on hate, and we've watched the rise of hate groups in our own country and around the world, and they've looked to other people to deal with that problem. And I think we're seeing the result of that today. In a moment in the 21st century, when we have the kind of weaponization of ideas that are happening online and corresponding to offline, we know that nothing stays domestic or international. Ideas have no borders. So I would urge us all to be more serious about the rise of hate, to take this, to take action in all kinds of ways in our cities and our towns, to make sure that young people are not joining organizations that find the us versus them ideology appealing.
Andre, thanks for that call. We're talking to Farah Pandith. Her new book is How We Win, How Cutting-Edge Entrepreneurs, Political Visionaries, Enlightened Business Leaders, and Social Media Mavens Can Defeat the Extremist Threat. Farah, one question you ran into a lot talking to young Muslims around the world had to do with how Muslims are treated here in the United States. Can you talk about that curiosity you encountered?
Yeah, I mean, Rob, one of the things that's important to remember is how different our country feels in a post 9/11 world. And for young kids that are growing up post 9/11 who happen to be Muslim in this country, it's a very different experience than young Muslims who grew up prior to 9/11, because there's been a fierce attention on them all day, every day, every single day since September 11th, 2001. And that fierce attention has manifested in all kinds of ways. It's made them feel very insecure around communities that their parents have lived in for many years without feeling anything. They get bullied in school. They think differently about their role here in America. And instead of taking an opportunity here in the United States to pause and to think about the impact of 9/11 on all of us, not just on the Muslim communities here, but on the rise of the way in which we think about the other. It's an opportunity for us as Americans to also think about real American history when it comes to Islam. And I think if we position this as an opportunity to learn, to understand that Islam came to this country at the time of the slaves, if we think differently about the fact that Muslims have been here since the beginning of our country, we can also have a very different way of thinking about their role here in the United States. Everybody needs to be treated with dignity. This isn't just about Muslims or another religious group. It's unfortunately a moment in our country when we are looking at race and gender and sexuality and religion in very different ways. And that change has happened in a very quick amount of time. It is having an impact on how we think about each other, and it's also having an impact on what we think about as we think about who we are as Americans. History matters.
And Farah, you see another challenge for American efforts and other efforts to counter extremism, that coming from Saudi Arabia and the elite in Saudi Arabia and what message they've been promoting around the world. What are you looking at?
One of the things I promised I would do when I left the State Department, when I wrote this book, I wanted to be very honest with the American public about what I had seen around the world in nearly 100 countries. And this book talks about the system that's underlying extremism. One component, as you rightly said, Rob, is what I talk about in terms of the data point of the identity crisis that's happening around the world for Muslim millennials. But the other piece, which is a really important plank, is the impact of 3 to 4 decades worth of an effort by Saudi Arabia to breed the kind of us versus them ideology that exists around the world, that is really, in fact, seated in all kinds of ways that's allowed the groups like Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and the so-called Islamic State to build off of that particular way, a very strident form of interpretation of religion. Let's not forget that the so-called Islamic State used Saudi textbooks in their so-called caliphate when they first began to build it. The ideology is very aligned. I think it's important that we as Americans understand that while we have a close relationship with Saudi Arabia, and I don't argue in this book that we should not, I'm simply saying that there need to be consequences for the actions that they have placed over 3 to 4 decades that have allowed this kind of ideology to bloom. And at the other end of this, Rob, if American troops are going overseas to fight wars that are dependent on an ideology that has grown out of a commitment by Saudi Arabia to showcase a very particular kind of Islam, we have the right to be able to call it out.
In our last few moments, Farah, do you see signs of hope that we are starting to take the approach that you're looking for?
From the government perspective, I do not. The Trump administration has actually decreased the funding for the kind of ideological programs. I don't see Congress talking about soft power and non-lethal power and scaling up what we know works. They can do that very easily in the budgets that are put forward for both the Department of Homeland Security and, in fact, the Department of State. And I do not see, so I don't see a change there, but I do see a larger recognition by people within communities that local solutions exist by community members. And there is more attention on what communities can do to scale up the kind of local ideas that they know can build resilience and build the antibodies in the system. This book is written out of optimism and hope. Solutions are available and affordable right now. We need to know that we can do more if you put our attention on this particular issue.
Farah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Farah Pandith was with us. Her new book is called How We Win, How Cutting-Edge Entrepreneurs, Political Visionaries, Enlightened Business Leaders, and Social Media Mavens Can Defeat the Extremist Threat.